His voice can make a wolverine purr. It's TV's Dean Haglund with his Christmas wish.
Someday, I'd like to be a dentist.
A dentist?
That was Dean Haglund's Christmas wish. We now return you to the sounds of the season from downtown Los Angeles, where it's a balmy 81 degrees.
Jingle, jingle bones, jingle all the way. Screech and groan, jingle, jingle bones on a witch's Christmas day.
Jingle, jingle bones, jingle, jingle bones, jingle all the way.
Jingle all the way, screech and groan, jingle, jingle bones on a witch's Christmas day.
Your Chilpack Hollywood Hour with Dean Haglund and Phil Lairness.
Merry Christmas, Dean Haglund.
Why, a Merry Christmas to you and yours and all the ships at sea.
I feel like already, in just the few seconds we've been in this show, the listeners have already been treated to Dean Haglund working on some IKEA furniture.
What are you talking about? I went to the quietest room I got. What are you... This, IKEA furniture.
And speaking of the listeners, this is your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour, sliding down your virtual chimney, stuffing your audio stocking full of podcasty goodness on Christmas Day. This actually is Christmas Day. We're recording one day later than we usually like, and we're probably more jacked up on eggnog than we ought to be.
Speak for yourself. I ought to be.
You ought to be. And you do get jacked up. I mean, that people thought human growth hormone, they thought anabolic steroids, but no, Dean Haglund, when he gets jacked, he's jacked on eggnog.
It only happens once a year that you can really get that off the shelf. So
all right. So speaking of shelves, you were regaling me with the new Haglund family Christmas tradition, cataloging comic books.
Okay, so there's some fantastic shelving that came with this place. And we are going to shelve all the comic books, perhaps 15,000 to 20,000 comic books that we brought from Los Angeles here. And I am reading the title and the publisher and the issue number of each one, which is then carefully recorded in an Excel spreadsheet, which we will then know exactly what we got where.
Yeah, and, sure. And these are going up on shelves. You've built shelves to display.
No, the shelves came with the place.
Oh, so built-ins. They're built-ins. Okay.
Yeah.
And so they're going to be displayed, cataloged. Now, how would you display them? And what kind of, do you go chronological? Do you go by alphabetical title? What do you do?
Well, this is why we're taking the entire Christmas week to do this. We're not sure if it goes alphabetical. If we go by the publishing groups, do we put them together in terms of art style? Is our underground comic press from the 60s separate from our action heroes versus the fantasy stuff? Plus, there's the one-offs printed only by the artist himself that we were issued at Comic-Cons around the world. How do you do it? We are in a tizzy of organizational nightmares.
And you're really under the gun because you say you're spending the week doing this, but I mean, the first tour of Detroit's one and only Canadian-American comic book museum begins, I think, on January 2nd, doesn't it? It's a guided tour.
Let's say that might be postponed.
As with Dean Haglund and most graphic novels.
Oh, damn you. I tell you how close I am on that graphic novel. Working feverishly with my Apple pen and iPad, putting pen to plastic pen to Gorilla glass on a daily basis.
If Paige Branson is listening, I hope that gives her some clarity, more clarity than I was able to provide her when I saw her at Lily and my engagement party at the Chevy Chase Club there in the nation's capital. So I said it seemed to be coming along great, and she asked what that meant, and at that point I was out of details. But you know what I was thinking?
I'm listening.
Because people love production meetings on the air. That's one thing that has not changed in 12 years of this show. And that's what I was thinking. I was thinking, you know, we didn't do a New Year's resolution show last year, and I'm kind
of—that's right.
I'm a little bit beyond the idea of the resolution show, but I like the idea. Next Monday is the final day of 2018,
and
what if we just do a thing, not a list of movies or TV shows, but just what stood out to us from 2018? Oh. What are the memories we know we're going to take forward, for better or worse? What are the indelible memories we're taking forward? And what are we looking forward to in 2019?
Right.
Yeah.
I like it.
Because I would think the bringing that graphic novel to audiences is something you'd be looking forward to, for example.
Well, absolutely. And what better place to do that than the Fan Run X Fest.
I know. Here. I know. That would be such a great opportunity. And when you say here, you mean there in Chicago.
I mean somewhere in the Midwest, there's a big convention happening.
Somewhere I flew over last night on Christmas Eve. By the way, I do have a cat who is healthier than ever, who was sicker than ever, had taken pneumonia 1 year ago. Today, and she's desperate to be a part of this show. So don't be surprised if she suddenly becomes a part of today's show.
Oh, fantastic!
She's knocking down piles of things to get at me while we're doing this. while I was setting up and while we're doing this recording. Anyway, hey, I had, you know, it is Christmas, and I know that this is a bizarre topic, the kind of thing that we don't really talk about. But you know, it is Christmas for a lot of people. One of the things they think of is angels. And of course, one of my favorite Christmas movies, my favorite Christmas movie is Wings of Desire, one of my 10 favorite movies of all time, which is about angels, after all. But the topic came up on this trip a couple of times.
Was there flight trouble?
No,
about
travel guardian angels, about how often just you have these bizarre experiences, and after the fact you go, there's no explanation other than that was a guardian angel who appeared towards me. To illustrate on this trip and why this came up, Lily and I flew in after a red eye to New York on, arrive early on a Thursday morning. I haven't had coffee. I haven't had sleep in days. I'm not at my best, nor dare I say my most fun to be around. Because we live in the year 2018 rather than, 10 years ago when I was kind of splitting time between New York and knew how to get to places on my own, we now have to rely on Alexa or Siri or Lady Google, right? And so, indeed, Lady Google tells us to take the air train to Jamaica Station. I've never been to Jamaica Station in all the times I've been to New York. I would go, I would go elsewhere. I would catch the A train. I would transfer. We're going to stay with our friends, John and Kelly Lawler, in Brooklyn. And it's a little bit tricky to get to their part of Brooklyn. So it involves change of trains. So when this particular Lady Google missive appeared towards me, I was excited about it because Uber was showing that Uber would cost 45 minutes and take 2 hours because it was rush hour. It was 8 o'clock in the morning.
$45 and take 2 hours.
Yeah.
Not 45 minutes.
No, $45 and take 2 hours. And so, or you can spend, what is it? You know, the $5.50 plus the subway fare to get to where we were going in 1 hour. Well, that sounds fantastic. So we take the air train to Jamaica Station
very easy.
And then ask people who work for MTA, and there's no better way to get them to just point and outright ignore you than to ask them direct questions. So then, because we're supposed to catch a bus, it looks like we're catching a bus, and we don't know anything about the bus routes. But it's gonna take us straight to the Barclays Center on Atlantic in Brooklyn, and then we hop on the queue, and it's a quick trip. I've now told everyone how to get to John and Kelly Lawler's, and you really should go because their hospitality is peerless in the greater tri-state area. But we couldn't find it. We couldn't find none of the buses at the nearest corner matched the number. Again, other than the fact that there was a Tim Hortons right where we were standing and not a Dunkin' Donuts, there was nothing that made me regret coming to New York more than this experience. It was snowing. I'm standing in the snow. People are ignoring. Lily's taking it upon herself. It's the first evidence on the trip of something that I had surmised for a long time, which is that her geographic instincts are absolutely unfallible. You can rely on them 100% of the time if you translate them into a 180-degree change. So wherever her instinct tells her to go, you know it's directly in the opposite direction, 100% of the
time. Okay.
Anyway, so we're trying to find this bus, and we're you know, with our luggage. And when I say we're with our luggage, I mean I'm with our luggage. She's carrying like one little bag of gifts, and I've got all the bags. And so finally, we're on this sidewalk, and we're under this overpass, and we're about to have it out. Like, we've lost our pay. We're about to turn on each other. And this man, and remember, everybody we've talked to said, I don't know, or just leave me alone. Or this man, African-American man, probably in his late 30s, smoking a cigarette, just says, are you lost? And he is treated to 10 minutes of utter nonsense from us. just useless information, utter nonsense, utter recriminations and bickering. And he replies at the end of the 10 minutes without moving, are you lost? And so we tell him where we need to go and how do we get there and what is this thing? And he does the dreaded points behind us to a staircase that seems to lead up to nowhere. And he explains, no, what it's saying is we need the Long Island Railroad. And he hasn't looked at it. He hasn't even looked at the directions. He hasn't listened to Google. He's just saying you need the Long Island Railroad. And it's up those steps. That's where you catch it. So we had stopped to have it out right where we needed to get to. So then, without saying another word, this man leads us into the terminal, or gets our tickets, walks us up the steps, walks us onto the train, sits down next to us, rides with us all the way to the Barclays Center on Atlantic, does not have any interest in engaging us in conversation, and who could blame him? And then, when the train gets off, walks from there, I know what to do, but he walks us to the Q train, make sure we get onto the Q train, and then he sets off on his way. And as he's leaving, I call out to him, sir, are you sure you'll know how to get where you're going without us? So who knows where this guy was going or what was happening or whatever. We never got his name. We never were able to thank him. As soon as he helped us, he was gone. And that's a travel guardian angel that appears.
Wow. That's a good, maybe he didn't exist at all.
Well, when Yoshi, and I were once in the ancient capital of Kyoto in Japan, cherry blossom season, the 1 week a year when the old imperial palace is open, we needed to get to a dinner, on the opposite end of the town from where our inn was. And, Yoshi didn't know how to get there, not a surprise. Yoshi's famous phrase, I've known him almost 50 years. This is what I would put on his epitaph. I got a little turned around. I would love to be there, but I got a little turned around. I thought, well, Yoshi will translate. He'll get somebody to tell us where. And that's when his lack of proficiency in Japanese really, really stood out. Which was funny because he'd kind of worked as an interpreter on some jazz projects, as I understood it in the past. Anyway, so he's hating hearing this when he listens to this show. We know that. But the story is great because we're standing there with just this woman just appears out of nowhere. Not a tall woman, not a short woman, not an old woman, not a young woman, just a woman. Appears out of nowhere. We point to the restaurant in this guidebook. She just nods and walks us 2 miles to the restaurant where we show up on time. And then we're trying to get people to translate to her at the restaurant. Please come in. We'll buy you dinner. Please help us. Please help us. And she just shakes her head no and nods and walks away and disappears into the night. I think it's the same guy.
Wow. Disappears when you need to and walks you to where you need to go.
Have you
over great distances?
So now you're once you became television's beloved Dean Haglund.
Yeah,
you have people lined up wanting to help you.
Yeah,
there's also another line, but there is the line of people who want to help you. But I mean, have you ever experienced anything like this? And have you ever experienced anything like this when you knew it wasn't, oh, this person's a fan of the X-Files or something?
Well, yes. When I traveled in my younger days, of course, I got my scholarship for university. Instead of paying tuition, I went on a horseshoe tour of the United States, starting in Vancouver, with a one-way airline ticket that got me to San Francisco. And from there, I had to get to my cousin's place down in Newport Beach using public transit and friends, mostly. So there's a tricky spot where the commuter train gets as far as San Jose from San Francisco.
Right.
And then from there, I had to get off the commuter train and get to another station. I guess it was a bus station. I can't quite remember now, but I do remember the conductor sort of telling me, okay, once you get off the train, make a right, go to left. This is long before we had Siri's and Alexa's telling us things. And then he said, hey, guess what? I'm finished. This is my last stop. Why don't I just drive you over? And the guy, not knowing me, just me and my backpack, he drives me over to the bus station, and I know on my way. And I would have never found it. And it was San Jose in the dangerous time when San Jose, you shouldn't have been walking around back then. And well, there you go. There's a story like that.
You know,
somebody just thought of.
It would be a fun. I don't know if it'd be a fun book. I like to think it'd be a fun book of you know, collecting travel guardian angel stories.
I think everybody's got one.
Everyone's
more or less.
Got at least one, and it really is spectacular. You know, remember when I was going to London and the UK to show a bunch of, you know, to have a bunch of screenings of The Truth Is Out There, and I was doing that one at Goldsmiths College. You know, for psychology of belief and. Yeah, I completely got screwed up at the tube station and where to catch the right bus, and I missed it, and I was never going to make it. And I went to a bus driver, and I just said, "Is there any other way that?" And he said, "You know, short of a cab," and then he just said, "Hop on."
Yeah.
And he's got a full bus, and he goes a totally different route to drop me off at Goldsmiths.
Wow.
And he said, you know, because I explained why I was going where I was going, and he said, you know, I've always wanted to drive someone from Los Angeles. So that's why. And so, like, everyone on the bus is going, you know, and it's a packed bus.
Right.
But they're all asking me questions, and they're all asking me questions about the movie. And and so they drop me off at the main gates of the university, and then they go on their way. And I didn't research, but I would not be surprised if it turned out that had been the 1 year anniversary of some deadly bus crash where everyone had perished. Right? Like it was a ghost bus.
Ghost bus. I like it.
All right.
Wow.
So many travel adventures. I want to hit you with a couple of things that you'll find interesting and to put on your put in your databanks, maybe catalog up there on one of the shelves, not taken by your Archie comics.
Not Archie. Well, I do have a couple of Archie.
Yeah, there's nothing wrong with that. Yeah. There's nothing wrong
with
it. Yeah,
you're right.
Yeah, there isn't anything wrong with it at all. So I, you know, I had a magical experience on Friday in New York where I got up early and took the train up to Bronxville. Oh, my goodness, what a beautiful town this Bronxville is. It's like you're stepping off into Back to the Future's set.
And, no, really?
and it's home of Sarah Lawrence College. And Sarah Lawrence College is a big deal in my imagination because it's where Joseph Campbell taught for so many decades when it was, you know, it was a female-only college. And it's been co-ed for, I think, at least 50 years. But my dear friend and high school debate partner, Sayuri Oyama, teaches there. And it was great because she basically ditched class to come and hang out with me. Class, we're going to the movie theater and you're watching Ujetsu today. And damn if we didn't end up there at the theater to watch some of it because we both love that movie so much. But so it was great fun, and we're talking about maybe doing some dates at Sarah Lawrence College in the spring with the Lady Killers. Because these are not issues, you know, the issues explored in the Lady Killers are not unimportant for the young people, right? I mean, maybe the most important people to talk to about the issues contained in that movie. But
right.
So that was wonderful and getting catching up. I mean, I just love this lady so much. And then went back to Manhattan. And that evening, Lily's Uncle Michael and Aunt Harrington and Cousin Beth threw an engagement, the New York City leg of the engagement party tour. For us.
Right.
And this was a fantastic party. And what always happens in Uncle Michael's apartment is that there is a time warp. I don't know if it's them or the apartment or New York or the drinks or what it is, but there is a time warp. A couple years ago, 2015, at a Christmas party, John Lawler and I constantly remind each other that at one point, we found ourselves laying, staring at the ceiling side by side on the master bedroom bed, and it was 3 o'clock in the morning, and everyone was still wearing hats and singing Christmas carols. This year, we're determined to get out in much better shape than that. And so the party starts at 6 o'clock. We're very happy at 10:40 when Uncle Michael is plying us with water. We think, okay, this is good. We'll keep drinking water. We'll be somewhat sober. We'll be out of here by midnight. At 2 a.m., we're on the subway. And we're staring at each other going, what happened? Like, we had no recollection of what happened between 10:40 and 2.
Oh my God.
So it's fantastic and terrifying, all the things that I love about New York. But this is what I wanted to share with you. We could not get to sleep, Lily and I, that night at 4 o'clock in the morning in the dark. She just says to me, in 3 years, we moved to New York.
What?
Yeah. So let's keep that. Let's keep that on the coordinates. I don't know. On the itinerary? I don't know what we do. But and it felt right. It felt absolutely right. So we may be starting a countdown really soon.
Look at that. Boy, that'd be a big move, wouldn't it? Or, no, you used to do time.
Well, I used to do time there. I was ready to start really being 80-20 New York and L.A. when Lily and I fell in love. And she had lived in New York and said never again, so LA it was. But
wow.
Yeah, that would be something, wouldn't it?
That would be something.
You know, in a couple winter months a year in LA.
Yeah, that's exactly our plan too. When it gets miserably cold in Detroit, we head to LA, avoid the snow, and then come back for spring.
Now,
what changed in New York that changed for Lily?
Just the people, the quality of the conversation, the everything felt right. Everything felt right now. Honestly, you know, there's a handful of people that I would rather hang out with in my pajamas than do almost anything else. It's not a long list. It's not a long list. And
right.
Lily is one of those people.
Great.
But Kelly and John are two of those people as well. And so it's just spectacular getting to spend time with them. And, you know, I got to see Dan Butler. Oh, my God. We have so much we could talk about on this show. But we went to a restaurant on Staten Island. I've never been to Staten Island.
Me neither.
And I was going to tell you about this a little bit later if we ever get to talking about movies, but because something really cool happened while coming up out of the subway near the Staten Island Ferry. But there's a restaurant there that's open Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sundays for dinner. And it's all the cooks are just grandmas from around the world. Basically, the name of the restaurant is not Grandmas from Around the World. I think it's Inoteca. And it's right by the, I think, the St. George Theater in on Staten Island. But it's good location for the island. But this place is so great. It's a small, cozy restaurant. And you always have an Italian grandma working in the kitchen. And then you have a grandma from some other country. And they just make up the menu that day. And so it's a combination of the two nations' cuisines on the menu that day. So we got Nona Carmen from Argentina, who I had read about and wanted to get and was so excited to get. But this restaurant, Dean, is cash only, and it's fantastic. It may not be – it's not the best meal I've ever had, but it's one – it's I can count them on one hand. Let me put it that way.
Wow.
It was that good and so much fun. And we went with the Lawlers and we went with Dan Butler, who, of course, is just a storyteller par excellence. So and you take the ferry past the Statue of Liberty to get there. What could be better? And, you know, the Staten Island Ferry is free. It's free, Dean Hagland.
It is? I didn't know that.
Yeah. So anyway, so that was cool. But I wanted to share just with you two quick things that one that I thought was hilarious and such a great, I don't know if this is travel guardian angel, but it's party etiquette guardian angel. And then something that moved me so much. We went to DC and we had an engagement party there at the Chevy Chase Club, and it was beautiful, so moving. But this is Lily's home turf, and this is her parents' friends and her extended relatives. And so, obviously, I know the people in the family. I have met, no doubt, many of the people who were guests, but not often enough or in manageable numbers enough where I can remember faces, names, and context of that meeting. That's just, it's just too much, you know?
So you
experience this a lot at conventions, but at least often you can know that the context was probably a convention.
Right.
So that throws another little monkey.
Narrows it down. Yeah, for sure.
But at one point, I don't think I was being overwhelmed, but maybe I seemed a little tense because, you know, I wanted to make a good showing. This gentleman pulls me aside to have what, by all accounts, seemed to be a very serious conversation. This is what Onwalker said. What did you guys talk about? That seemed like, you know, like we were discussing the secrets to the universe. But what this man said to me was, let me give you some advice.
Plastics.
Yeah, and I'm thinking, plastics, or it's marital advice, or because I've gotten some bad advice from older men about marriage before. Don't kid yourself. And so anyway, he said, none of us expect you to know who we are. So just have fun. And I said, sir, you have no idea how much I appreciate that advice, especially coming from you, since I have no idea who you are.
And he said,
no. So that
go
way
to
he,
hell.
He, no, he, so he was just perfect. Anyway, so isn't that great? But every time I get together with Lily's mom, and this time it was courtesy of Lily's stepdad, and I don't know if stepdad-in-law is a thing, but I never thought I'd be so excited to have someone as a stepdad-in-law, but I really dig Lily's stepdad, Barlow. And courtesy of him and Betsy, I attended an event at the Kennedy Center for the first time, and I'd never been to the Kennedy Center. So, and this was a big black tie event. But what really moved me about it was that I only realized then, because of course, obviously, you've got a pretty good chance it's named for John F. Kennedy. Right? Probably.
Yeah,
pretty good.
Probably. Why not?
So I mean, it could have been named for Sully's, my friend Sully's daughter, Kennedy, but probably not. The years don't work. So,
right.
So, you know that it's named for, but what doesn't occur to me until I'm in there, and Betsy said that people really forget this a lot, is that that's the Kennedy Memorial.
What?
You know, just like the Lincoln Memorial or the Washington or the Jefferson Memorial. It's not just named for him. That's his memorial. And so the sculpture and the tributes to him are so moving. And and there's a quote from him, and I am going to paraphrase
butcher
this. Yeah, probably butcher it, but it's still the meaning is profound. But it's a quote from him and why they named made the Center for the Arts his memorial was because he once said that the life of the arts, far from being an interruption or a distraction in the life of a nation, is probably closer to the center of the heart of the purpose of that nation than any other endeavor.
Oh.
And isn't that really touching?
That is. That's a direct quote from him?
Yeah, I mean, I got... hopefully I got 80% of it right, you know, but that is what he said. And you know, I've said this before, that in the darkest of times, it comforts me to remember that history is not alone the study of wars or the study of plagues or the study. It is equally as often it's the study of culture, right?
Right. Absolutely.
Maybe it's an equal battle between the destructive and the creative when we study history, but it is equal at the very least.
Yes. Fantastic. Wow. So that's cool.
Yeah. So that was.
And did you see a show at the Kennedy Center?
I did. We attended the grand annual gala for the choral arts. It was a tremendous concert. A wonderful Christmas concert. It was the host for this year, because every year it's a different ambassador who's the patron. And it was the Dutch ambassador. And oh my goodness, he was hilarious. And so they did some of the carols in traditional, is it Danish?
Dutch.
Is that what they, is it Dutch? I don't know.
Dutch. It's Dutch language.
Yeah, okay. But it's the Netherlands. Yeah. The Netherlands. Right, exactly. That's what gets me a little bit confused sometimes, having never been there. But And it was fantastic because the after party, there's a silent auction and there's an after party with dancing, and the gala party was decorated with so many Van Goghs, and because I guess the big Van Gogh museum is in Amsterdam, right?
That's right.
And
the nephew started it all.
And the ambassador was great. He stood up and he said, "Now, there will not be auctioning on these. I had thought about auctioning these off, seeing as how they are not the original paintings. But I don't want you to think that they are replicas or recreations. As the White House would say, they're alternative paintings." Yeah, it was really good. It was really, really
good. That's a good one.
All right.
That's a good one.
So enough frivolity and I don't know, what do you call it? Merrymaking. We're going to bring the room down a little bit because we do have to, but we'll continue the celebrations as we celebrate the lives of some illustrious show business personages.
Oh.
Celebrity deaths.
Dean, America is mourning the passing of, if they paid attention to this, given the fact that Penny Marshall upstaged her, they are mourning the passing of not only one of this country's greatest voices in every way you might think of that term, but a truly great American, Nancy Wilson, who, of course, was a great artist, born in 1937, died in this year, just a couple weeks ago, Grammy and Emmy Award-winning singer who sang many styles of music, most closely associated with jazz. Among her notable recordings are the 64 hit "You Don't Know How Glad I Am" and her debut single "Guess Who I Saw Today." I mean, her voice was transcendent, just if there's a Rushmore of great singing voices, she's on it.
Right.
But there isn't, so don't go looking for it.
Oh, okay.
Aware of her singing talent from a young age, she transformed her gift for song into a performing and recording career that spanned more than half a century, beginning in the 1950s and extending until her retirement well into the 2010s. Described as a consummate entertainer, she made frequent television appearances. She won an Emmy for her own series, The Nancy Wilson Show, in 1974. She hosted NPR's music show Jazz Profiles. Are you shaking?
I don't think that.
Are you shaking jingle bells? That's the question.
No.
Okay. All right.
Are you hearing jingle bells?
Yeah, we're kind of hearing jingle bells from your end of the things.
No, unless Santa has arrived late.
All right. Okay, that's fine.
Could
that's,
be.
You know what I've learned? Bells. What I've learned is the listeners love when I call you out on noise that's coming from your end of the. That's
there's no
love.
Noise. Yeah. I am in a silent room.
So. Well, we're going to have to agree to disagree on that one.
What? That's impossible.
Yeah. They might point out that it's a silent room while you're talking. Okay. Well, no, I don't mean that what you're saying is silent. Anyway, all right. You know what? God. Let's at least agree to disagree and get along, because it's what Nancy Wilson would have wanted.
Right.
So that it's Jazz true. Profile series, though, which was so good, ran for almost a decade from 96 through 2005. She won a Peabody Award for that show.
Wow.
She won 3 Grammys for albums during her career. And beyond all that, beyond singing and hosting on radio and television, she was an activist in the civil rights movement. She was a spokeswoman for the Urban League, and she was one of the earliest to promote AIDS awareness.
Wow. Look at that.
Now, the next celebrity death is a really odd one, because I did what you do when you fly home from the East Coast to L.A., I stayed up late to get on California time by watching the 1970s, a rather awful post-World War II suspense thriller, Brass Target, about the purported assassination of George Patton, right?
Right.
You remember this? Remember this? Like it was rejected as such folly because, of course, Patton dies in 1945 in Germany in a car accident. But there were all these conspiracy theories about him having been assassinated. But in 2008, right. There was a book written that kind of lent some credence to these ideas.
Right.
But as with every conspiracy thriller, it's about Nazi loot and Nazi gold and a train. And like most of them, should have it, one of the star, the two stars are Cassavetes and Patrick McGoohan. But why did I bring this up? Because the name of the suspected assassin was Peter Shelley. And who's the next celebrity death that we have to discuss? Peter Shelley, the longtime lead singer and songwriter of the highly influential punk band The Buzzcocks.
Oh, I didn't know that.
You didn't know that he died, or you didn't know that he was supposedly a World War II assassin?
I didn't know he died. I assuming as a World War II assassin, he would have been a little late to the new wave punk movement.
And but he dies in Estonia, which lends some credence to the fact that he may have escaped after World War II.
Wow, Estonia.
Okay, so this
Now,
were you a Buzzcocks fan? I mean, I know you're into your punk. I mean, they were
yes.
They were one of the real pioneers of punk. They were inspired, like many, to form in 1975 after seeing the Sex Pistols perform.
Right.
They started in Manchester, and you know, they had some strong pop hooks to go along with the intense energy of their songs. Were you a Buzzcocks fan?
I was a Buzzcocks fan. I don't think I ever saw them live. I believe one or two of their songs existed. And as Langley, I don't think we got the clearance, though I was supposed to wear one of the T-shirts. For some reason, the Buzzcocks legal team did not provide clearance. For me to wear one of their T-shirts on the X-Files.
You know why? Because you're named Langley, which is where the CIA is headquartered, and Pete Shelley was named for a potential George Patton assassin. So Why would the CIA want you to have clearance? That's the real.
Yeah, that's.
I feel like this just became our worst episode of the year, and it's my fault. It was going. We were talking about travel, guardian angels, and everything was just going. All right. Anyway, okay. I'm going to continue with this because it gives me the opportunity to name the band Husker Du, which is always fun.
Oh, yes. Love Husker Du.
The band never achieved a superstardom, but they greatly influenced many musicians. And we talk about these guys sometimes, you know, these kind of performers where they never became household names except in the households of people who are household names, where they're the artists that inspired them, right? And that's sometimes the way that it is in all art forms. You've got people who really break new ground, and then you have the people who can translate that journey into wider acceptance.
Right. Yes, exactly. Hear what you're trying to do. See, you know, understand its very mechanics and bring that forward.
And water it down. Okay.
They water it down sometimes. Yeah, unfortunately.
I mean, that's unfair because some of these are some of the most popular bands. But like Green Day used their blueprint. Yeah. They were their heroes. The Buzzcocks were Green Day's heroes. Nirvana, Husker Du, all were big, big fans and used their blueprint. The Buzzcocks' biggest hit song was Ever Fallen in Love with Someone You Shouldn't Have, which hit number 12 in the UK in 1978. It was a classic punk ballad about unrequited teenage love. The band broke up in 81 and reformed in 89. So I got to see them in the 90s, but I don't feel like I ever saw them. You know, I feel like if you didn't see them in their first iteration when punk was new, It's a little bit of, no matter how great or fiery or whatever they were, it's still a show about nostalgia in some way.
Right.
And I'm not a big fan. I'm not a big fan of the nostalgia, as you know.
I hear that.
He released several solo albums, had a minor hit in 1981 with his first single, good song, Homo Sapien.
All right. I remember that one.
Okay. So two female directors shuffled off the mortal coil, and I say female directors intentionally because they are two of the reasons why I think we finally gotten to the point where we no longer need to say female directors. We get to say directors.
Right.
And we wouldn't have gotten there without these two ladies. The first was Sandra Louise Anderson. You may remember her better under her professional name, Sandra Locke.
She
made her film debut in 1968 in The Heart is a Lonely Hunter, for which she was nominated for an Academy Award for Best Supporting Actress right out of the chute. She went on to star in such films as Willard, The Outlaw Josie Wales, The Gauntlet, Every Which Way But Loose, Bronco Billy, Any Which Way You Can, and Sudden Impact. Do you notice a trajectory on that career?
Yes. Quite incredible.
It's I do big films and then I get noticed by Clint Eastwood and I don't work with anyone else ever again.
Is that what happened?
It is kind of what happened. She has an interesting autobiography called The Good, the Bad, and the Very Ugly, A Hollywood Journey, published in 97. So she won a nationwide talent search in 67 for the part of Mick Kelly in the big screen adaptation of Carson McCullers' The Heart is a Lonely Hunter, opposite Alan Arkin. Before that, she had only starred in like a half dozen theater productions in her town, I think in Texas it was, with her husband, Gordon Anderson, for their Circle Players Incorporated.
Right.
And the film was released in the summer of 68 to critical acclaim. Like I said, she got the Academy Award as well as a pair of Golden Globe nominations, one for Supporting Actress and the other for Most Promising Newcomer. Now, she had married actor-sculptor Gordon Lee Anderson because I thought, wow, she was married when she fell in love and started shacking up with Eastwood? Not that that doesn't happen in show business, but she married him in 67 and she stated in the court papers that the marriage was never once consummated because her relationship was with a gay man and was tantamount to sister and brother. She testified under oath that they had been the closest childhood friends, and he was very, it was a brother-sister relationship. He was the sister. That's what she said.
I see.
This is like in her book and stuff. It's fascinating. But
fascinating now. I want to read this.
So her career reaches a turning point in 75 when she takes the supporting role in Outlaw Josie Wales as the love interest of Clint Eastwood's character, right? And it's that's a great movie, The Outlaw Josie Wales. And it's followed by a lead role alongside Eastwood in the big hit The Gauntlet. And like I said, they did so many films together that she ended up just becoming identified with Clint Eastwood movies, including the huge hit Every Which Way But Loose. I mean, people don't realize that that was one of Clint's biggest grossing films. It was the second biggest hit of 1978, for crying out loud. And the 1980 sequel, Any Which Way You Can, was almost as successful. So anyway, her favorite was Bronco Billy, where she plays a bitter heiress in a who joins a traveling Wild West show, and that's a nice little movie, but it's one of his least successful, obviously, and it's the least successful of the movies they did together. But then they go on to do Sudden Impact, which was the highest grossing film in the Dirty Harry franchise. So say what you will about her as an actress, and some people did, but their collaborations were among some of Clint's most successful. All right. In 1986, things start to change. She makes her feature directorial debut with Rat Boy, a fable about a boy who is half rat. You don't, which is so fascinating for a woman who had starred in the film Willard, right? But it's cool. That's a cool little movie. Really underrated at the time. And it was produced by Eastwood's company, Malpasso. It only had a limited release. It was a critical and financial flop, but was well received in Europe, including winning a lot of awards in France. And and they were she was ahead of the time on that. I mean, she pointed the way to some real interesting 90s independent cinema. And so she concentrated almost exclusively on directing from that point forward, including her second film, which was a pretty big movie, called Impulse, starring Teresa Russell. It was released in 1990, and it was about a police officer on the vice squad who goes undercover.
I vaguely remember that.
Now, the big final chapter of Sandra Locke's career comes in 1989, starts in 89, when she files a palimony suit against Clint Eastwood because he doesn't like that she's developing. I mean, I'm reading the tea leaves on this, but he pretty much doesn't want a powerhouse woman director to be sharing his house with him. So she comes home from the set one day to find that the locks have been changed on their Bel Air home. And all her possessions have been sent to storage. So there's a year-long battle. They reach a settlement wherein, as part of the settlement, Eastwood sets up a film development directing pact for Locke at Warner Brothers using his connections in exchange for her dropping the suit. All right.
Okay.
About 6 years later, and now see, we talked about this on some of the earliest episodes of Chill Pack Hollywood, hour back when it was from the heart of Hollywood, because it was still ongoing at that point. But she has to sue him again for fraud in 1995, alleging that the deal with Warner Brothers was a sham, because the studio had rejected all of the 30 or more projects she proposed and never once used her as a director. According to the statement, it was the ultimate betrayal by arranging a bogus deal as a way to keep her out of work. So again, he settles the case out of court for an undisclosed amount of money. The outcome of the case, Locke said, sent a loud and clear message to Hollywood that people cannot get away with whatever they want to just because they're powerful. And
right.
Now, what you might remember is that she brought a separate action against Warner Brothers for conspiring with Eastwood in this regard to sabotage her directorial career. And it was that trial where it was just a parade of just, what would you call it? Unctuous might be the right word. Powerful white men. You know, just slimy and confident and smarmy, one after another taking the stand, and one woman sitting alone as they all pile on her and talk about how she was a no talent and he'd been propping her up. And guess what? The jury didn't respond too well to that, to a bunch of rich white bullies.
Right.
And so there, it ended in an out-of-court settlement in 99. And for some reason, we were still talking about this when we started the show 8 years later. I guess this had come up or there were similar cases, and and that case was being cited. Because it was a case that would become part of the textbooks to illustrate the legal concept of good faith in negotiating.
Yeah, right? That's the thing. You deliver on what you negotiated on. Isn't that the whole idea?
But also just the idea that you have the intention of delivering on it when you negotiate it.
Right.
That
negotiating good faith. That's the term.
That your intention can be litigated.
All right. Yes.
After the fact. Things might not work out. But you can litigate whether the person ever intended for them to work out. And I think that's really interesting. She was a breast cancer survivor. She underwent a double mastectomy chemotherapy in 1990. Lived a long time. Survived a long time after that. Mm-hmm. And but during the treatment, began dating one of her surgeons who was 17 years younger than her and fell in love with him. And they moved in and got married. But I bring this up because one line in her obituary has really stood out to me to let me know just how good those settlements were with Warner Brothers and Eastwood. In 2001, she purchased a 6-bedroom home for her and her husband in the Hollywood Hills where they then resided.
Wow.
She hadn't worked in quite a while. But a 6-bedroom home, how much would that set you back?
And well, maybe the DGA residuals are good.
A 6-bedroom home good?
I don't know. I don't know the answer to that.
I mean, that's got 7 zeros before the decimal point, that sale.
At least,
you know. So anyway, so Sandra Locke. And, of course, Penny Marshall died.
And Penny Marshall, yes. That was a surprise.
Is it?
I don't know.
Death must come to all people, Dean Haglund.
I know. Just I thought there was a sequential order in terms of, I don't know. She seems so young is what I'm saying.
Yeah, that's it. Is that you look up and you go, she was 75? Wow, and 75 isn't old. I mean, our friend Tucker Smallwood's turning 75. You know,
right?
I mean, you don't think that, you know, it could happen.
Exactly.
That is still young. I just turned 50. And the thing is, I am so shocked, Dean, at how old I look in photos, because the truth is I have never felt younger.
Well, see, this is the whole raison d'etre of why we
do this
mark
podcast.
A time.
Oh,
do this podcast. Exactly. To stay and feel young. Stay connected with our finger on the pulse.
What do we want to talk about with her? I mean, it's interesting how to different generations, she's almost totally different people, right? Star of the popular sitcom Laverne and Shirley, then moves behind the camera, becomes the first woman to direct a film to make $100 million at the domestic box office, and then repeats that feat. Just a little while later. Becoming a successful actress on television in the 70s with a recognizable Bronx accent. I mean, think of all the reasons why people could say no to her.
Right? Yes. She's thick accent, all of that. But comedy chops, timing.
But she
had that.
But she doesn't look like what sitcom stars were supposed to look like, or would end up looking like even. She doesn't sound like it. But she paves the way in some regard. And here's something for nepotism, by the way. Because Gary Marshall, her brother,
right,
casts her and Cindy Williams as the pair of friends in an episode of Happy Days. And as a favor. But that's the only favor, the only door he ever opened for her. He never had to ever again, because they burst out of the gates like they were shot out of a cannon, right? And
yeah,
so popular,
sure,
that they get a sitcom that exceeds the rating success at times even of Happy Days. And
amazing.
And so there is something for nepotism, right? It drives me nuts when people either refuse to have their relatives help them or relatives refuse to help them. If in good faith they have a belief that these people are talented, give them a hand. You know?
Why not?
Give it.
Exactly.
But then make them earn it. Make them deliver.
Right.
And that's what Gary Marshall did. And because no one else was going to. And we're grateful that he did. I mean, we would have been deprived of those characters and those performances without. So she moves on from acting to become a top director at a time when I don't think, you know, Sandra Locke does it. But it's kind of stunning when you think about it. There were others, Betty Thomas, who had starred on Hill Street Blues. So this was the age in the 80s where women were saying, I'm going to step behind the camera.
I want to direct. Yeah.
And Diane Keaton was doing this, and
but
they're the outliers at that point. And so what's stunning about when she died, again, the timing of it was stunning, because I was literally having a conversation, a little bit of a debate the night before, about maybe one of the reasons why you don't see Big so often anymore, and it's because that film's really creepy. It's really inappropriate. At the heart of it is an inappropriate relationship between a grown woman and a prepubescent boy.
Right.
And they have sex. They have sex.
Yes.
And
she didn't know.
She didn't know. And he, which is exactly Kevin Spacey's defense in what I'm sure the new Massachusetts case is going to be. By the way, did you see Kevin Spacey came out of hiding to release a YouTube video in character as Frank Underwood?
Ew.
Yeah, it is so gross. You got to go to his Twitter feed and find it. It is so gross, and it came out in response to the sexual assault allegations leveled against him in a Massachusetts court about him raping an underage boy after getting him drunk. And he's having fun with it. It is so disturbing. Anyway, she doesn't know, but not knowing again is fine for her, but we know. That's why it's creepy. That's why it's creepy, because we look back and we go, 30 years ago, we were all right with knowing, because she didn't know. And that's not all right for us anymore. Let me go further on a couple points. One, they don't need to have sex. It is not needed in the film at all. But it's part of that male fantasy that don't all young boys want to lose it to a hot older lady, right? Because all the old white men running Hollywood like to go back and re-engineer their youths of how they want it to play out. But the point is a serious one, and it's one that doesn't get discussed enough, which is that... You know, I love Bill Maher, but one of the things that I really dislike that he always says is, you know, when a teenage girl has an inappropriate relationship with her teacher, it's rape. When a teenage boy has an inappropriate relationship with his female teacher, it's good luck. and it's wrong because... The emotional weight on it, you know, the emotional development on it. And that's the thing. It's really unfortunate. And So anyway, I just was positing because Lily was saying, just can't watch it anymore. I mean, it's just, you know, you can't. And I was positing that's why you really don't see it so much anymore.
Interesting. Yeah.
It plays really, well,
like
really
you said, a lot of romantic comedies, their politics are way off.
Absolutely.
You know, Creepy Stalking was considered, you know, even the 50s, you know, where the woman is banging the guy's chest while he's kissing her, and then slowly she swoons and falls into his arms. Like, what? When does that ever happen?
And, you know, it doesn't mean that you trash these, put these in the dustbin of history.
Right.
Birth of a Nation's a wonderful point, right? Triumph of the Will is an excellent point. These are appalling propaganda.
Yes.
And they were at the time appalling propaganda. And so some people might be tempted to say, well, you can't judge it by now. You have to judge it by the context of the times. This is the argument that my sister and my mom would always have about the founding fathers. You know, you can't right. judge them for having owned slaves. It was the context of the time. And my mom said, why can't we judge them for that? Why?
That's a good question.
Yeah. Why is it exactly that we can't? The everyone was doing it defense?
Yeah.
Surely, anyway, but the point is, these movies are not lost. They are still held up for a variety of reasons for study. And one of
right.
them is so that we do learn the danger, the impact that popular storytelling can have in propagating a message in the psyche of a populace.
Right.
Yeah.
Yes.
And
we see the results of that. And you can see it in the historical context, too, right?
So
over a period of time.
Anyway, so Big is the one that grosses $100 million. And then again, as we say, she repeats that feat just a couple years later with League of Their Own.
Right.
And other movies, the Robert De Niro, Robin Williams, Oscar-nominated vehicle, Awakenings. In 2001, she directed her last movie, Riding in Cars with Boys, which starred Drew Barrymore. Penny Marshall, dead.
Penny Marshall.
75. And that's the end of a jam-packed episode. And like I said, we didn't get to so much. There was so much movie stuff that I wanted to get to. So let's just wrap with a 30-second production meeting about a show that maybe we'll pre-record. I still want to talk to you about that thing you brought up several weeks ago about how the distribution company A24 I like so much has signed that deal with iTunes and what that what that might mean.
Right. Let's chat that up.
And I did something that is both geeky and I thought kind of interesting given the concept of looking back at shows we've done in the past. But one of the things, Dean, we used to talk about when we first did this show was how frustrating it was that the movie business was not year-round, that that you would only release films that you thought were going to be hits in May, June, July, November, and December. And you only released movies that you thought were good in May as counter-programming, but then not in June and July because all the screens were taken by the blockbusters.
Blockbusters.
And then you would start releasing them again in September, October, November, December because you were pushing for awards. And we thought that they were ignoring some historical precedents that the industry just thought were outliers. Things like the February 14th release of Silence of the Lambs, which becomes a huge blockbuster and wins Best Picture. But they would refuse. So we were talking about how January was a dumping ground. August was a dumping ground. There were just, you know, cemeteries of dead-on-arrival movies being released. And we posited that the appetite was there year-round. Well, look, let's...
Yeah.
Just 10 years later, 12 years later, it is year-round.
It is year-round now.
And for sure. And to prove that, I took what critics are calling the 50 best films of 2018, and I put them in a chart of when they were released in the U.S.
Oh, look at you, Mr. Organized.
And in the process, of course, some of these are some of the biggest hits. so we would be able to talk about when they came out and, you know, can we see how the calendar is being used? And therefore, can we expect to look forward to more of the same as the years move on?
Fantastic.
I think it's fascinating, is it not, that the biggest hit of the year was released on February 16th. The second biggest hit of the year was released on April 27th. The two biggest hits of the year were released before the months when the big hits were supposed to come out, historically. Yeah. And
which shows you nobody knows nothing.
Well, maybe they're finally catching on.
Or maybe they catch on.
And what might be the influences behind this? Is it maybe because of the shorter release windows to streaming and home video and wanting to take advantage of the advertising that is now starting to make this more of a full calendar? So anyway, I thought this could be a fun thing for to look at. It also gives us an opportunity to discuss some of these films that we haven't had a chance to discuss before, and maybe even to carve out a real path of what work we need to do before we do our top 10 movies of the year, which we always do towards the end of January.
Right. Okay. So the production meeting then says we are doing another live show the next week and then potentially pre-record something else.
Well, do you want – I mean, why don't we – what do you want to do next week? Do you want next week's show that we release to be the what we're looking forward to and what we're looking back on? I mean, it is going to be December 31st. That feels kind of right.
Well, yeah, that does, doesn't it?
And then,
holy crap.
And then our first Monday of January, we'll look at this this calendar year
release
of the film business of 2018 and what it tells us as we move forward. I think that could be a lot of fun. And
let's do that.
And by the way, we're guaranteed to talk about no less than 50 movies in one show.
That's quite an accomplishment. That's 30 seconds per, well, I'm not doing the math. I was told to be no math.
You're doing it wrong. But it's 30 seconds per movie if we mention each movie twice. All right, that's it.
It could happen.
Everybody, you know where to find the shows. We're on chillpackhollywood.com. You can find all of the shows we've ever done. We're well over time. We want you to get on with spending some time with your family. So, Dean, good luck with your cataloging.
It's a celebration.
Give my love and Christmas wishes to Patty. And
thank you.
And we'll talk
right back at you.
We'll talk next week.
Look forward to it.
Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas, everyone.
Guests of your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour stay at the Baldwin Hills Motor Inn. Promotional consideration paid for by Empire State Gas. From farm to pump, we've got great gas. Belated spoiler alert.